This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 43, Case Update Special. In this episode, I'll provide updates on some of the cases I covered on early episodes of the podcast, which is something I hope to do periodically going forward. My sources for this episode were the Northwest Herald, the Daily Herald, CBS Chicago, the Chicago Tribune, NBC Chicago, ABC 7 Chicago, the Daily Mail, Facebook, Newsday, News 12 The Bronx, Patch, the Montgomery Herald, the Register Herald, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, Montana.gov, Wikipedia, KHQ, 13 News Now, various prison and state and county court portals, official documents, and in some cases, family members. First things first, I want to give a quick shout out to my newest patron, Stacy from Texas. Thank you so much, Stacy. Every monthly pledge gets me that much closer to my ultimate goal of devoting myself full-time to the podcast and the blog. If you'd like to support the show with a monthly pledge, you can visit www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com and click Become a Patron in the upper right corner. To make a one-time donation, you can visit www.sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com/support. I appreciate every single one of my listeners, readers, and patrons. Thank you so much for your support. One more thing before I get started. Please give a listen to this promo for a fantastic true crime comedy podcast about the dark side of online dating. You Should Have Ghosted.
Hello!
We are You Should Have Ghosted.
A true crime online dating podcast.
I'm Shayna, and I love true crime, wine, and I met my husband online.
I'm Liz, and I'm single and exploring online dating.
We're ex-coworkers who became best friends through our obsession with true crime podcasts and decided we should make one of our own.
You Should Have Ghosted is a podcast that we hope will enlighten people to the dark side of online dating and shine a light on serious issues with accountability in the dating app world.
Join us for dark stories and cringy content.
See you next Tuesday!
Before I get into the updates, I also want to address something that's come up a couple times in recent comments. It seems some people take exception to the name of my podcast. My best guess is that they're interpreting it literally, in the modern sense, rather than understanding the reference, so I wanted to give a little background about why I chose Suffer the Little Children as the name of both my blog and my podcast. Back in February, I posted an explanation on SufferTheLittleChildrenBlog.com, and it's been my pinned post ever since. I may have mentioned this in a previous episode as well, but I thought it was worth bringing up again in light of the recent comments. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I have my own spiritual beliefs, and I have a strong sense of right and wrong. I'm a highly empathetic person, and I adore children more than anything else in the world. For that reason, even though I have to admit I've never read the Bible in its entirety, a couple of passages have caught my attention over the years. The first quote comes from Matthew 18:1 through 10.
At the same time came the disciples unto Jesus, saying, Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a little child unto him, and set him in the midst of them, and said, Verily I say unto you, except ye be converted, and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. But whoso shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck, and that he were drowned in the depth of the sea.
The way I interpret this is that small children are innocent, loving, forgiving, affectionate, and without guile, and Jesus wanted his followers to manifest the same traits. From this passage, it also sounds like Jesus had zero patience for anyone who would harm a child, which I can certainly get behind. Then there are the passages from which I chose the title of the blog and the podcast. From Matthew 19:13-15.
Then there were brought unto him little children, that he should put his hands on them and pray, and the disciples rebuked them. But Jesus said, Suffer little children, and forbid them not to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And he laid his hands on them, and departed thence.
From Luke 18:15-17.
And they brought unto him also infants, that he would touch them. But when his disciples saw it, they rebuked them. But Jesus called them unto him, and said, Suffer little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God. Verily I say unto you, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child shall in no wise enter therein.
Basically, what Jesus was saying to his apostles, who were trying to keep the children from approaching Jesus, was that they shouldn't prevent the kids from reaching him. He wanted his followers to be like these children in order to get into heaven. So the bottom line is this. Jesus preached patience for and kindness toward children and valued adults with the same character traits as children display. I'm fully on board with that, and from that came the name of my blog and my podcast, Suffer the Little Children. In the examples I gave, the word suffer actually means permit. The subject matter of the stories I cover fits in with the modern usage of the word suffer, of course, and I'm all about a little wordplay. However, the most compelling reason I chose the name was the biblical reference. It also doesn't hurt that there is a Stephen King short story in one of his collections with the same title. I've been a huge Stephen King fan since I was 12 years old, so naturally that tends to stick with me. Another question I get frequently is, how can you stand to write and podcast about these stories? That is a fair question. Being as empathetic as I am and caring about children as much as I do, these stories are brutal to research and to cover, but because I feel so strongly about making this world a better place for kids, I feel it's my calling in life to keep telling these stories, for a few reasons. One, the people responsible for harming the children I write about should have their names and faces blasted out across the internet for the world to see. Anyone who could do what these people have done, allegedly in some cases, to a child deserves public vilification. Two, publicizing these tragic stories brings awareness to them, and enough public outcry and advocacy can lead, and in many cases has led, to changes in laws and policies to better protect children from abuse and neglect at the hands of their parents or guardians. Some examples are Niece Marie's Law, Elisa's Law, Kaylee's Law, Jonathan's Law, and the October Perez Law, among others. Right now, lawmakers are hammering out the details for proposed laws inspired by several of the kids I've covered, including Rayleigh Browning, Thomas Valva, and Max Schollenberger, among others. And finally, these kids deserve to have their stories told. Their voices were stolen from them at tragically young ages, and they didn't have the opportunity to tell their own stories, so it's very important to me to do it for them. They also deserve to be remembered, and helping keep their memories alive is the most important part of this for me. That said, I've been writing the blog since April of 2019, and since February of this year, I've worked virtually every day on both the blog and the podcast, featuring new cases and posting updates to the blog about the various cases I have covered. Between the blog and the podcast, I've covered the stories of nearly 100 children, and for those whose court cases are ongoing, I've followed those as closely as possible, posting updates on the blog. I also mark each child's birthday and the anniversaries of their deaths on my various social media accounts to help ensure these kids are never forgotten. Needless to say, it's a lot of work, and I'm only one person. These stories do weigh heavily on my heart, and I'll admit I immerse myself in them for most of my waking hours, which, for obvious reasons, takes a toll. In the interest of keeping myself somewhat sane, I won't be releasing an episode on December 30th. I'm just planning to take the week to recharge my mental batteries and enjoy the holiday season with my own kids, who are 13 and 16 now. Don't worry, I'll be right back to the weekly episodes on January 6th, 2021. Thank you so much for understanding, guys. In episode 1, I covered the story of 5-year-old AJ Frund, whose parents reported him missing on April 19, 2019, from their dilapidated, trash-filled home in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Since that episode, a ton has happened in AJ's case, including some measure of justice, which I'll get into. I mentioned this in a subsequent episode, but in case anyone missed it, on March 4, 2020, the home at 94 Dole Avenue, where AJ was beaten to death by his mother, was demolished. Neighbors and members of the Crystal Lake community lined the street to watch the House of Horrors come down and to honor AJ's memory. Many recorded the demolition with their cell phones. The house on Dole Avenue was in terrible condition, racking up 41 code violations, including mouse droppings, mold, missing flooring, subflooring, plaster, and drywall, animal waste, trash, and locks on interior doors, including AJ's bedroom and even his closet, both of which were padlocked from the outside. After it was deemed uninhabitable by the city of Crystal Lake, it stood unoccupied since the arrest of AJ's parents, Andrew Frund Sr. and Joanne Cunningham, almost 11 months prior. The house was torn down with all of the family's belongings still inside, reduced to a pile of rubble. Next is an update on AJ's case that I covered in episode 22, which was the sentencing of his mother, Joanne, who pleaded guilty in December of 2019. Her two-day sentencing hearing took place on July 16th and 17th, 2020. Episode 22 was full of fascinating and compelling testimony from the sentencing, at the end of which Joanne was sentenced to a pathetic 35 years in Illinois State Prison. At the beginning of August, Joanne was transferred to Logan Correctional Center in Lincoln, Illinois, to begin her sentence. There is some good news in AJ's case, at least. On September 10th, two former employees of the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services were arrested for their failure to act to save AJ. The DCFS workers in question are 54-year-old Carlos Acosta, who was the caseworker overseeing AJ's case in 2018, and his former supervisor, 48-year-old Andrew Paulovin. After an internal investigation into their handling of AJ's case, DCFS Inspector Merrill Paniak recommended the men's termination, saying they ignored opportunities to intervene and
failed to see the totality
of the problematic history of the Cunningham Frund family, which included drug addiction and allegations of abuse and neglect. Both men left DCFS in December of 2019. At the time of his contact with AJ's family, Acosta's caseload was above the allowed threshold based on a federal decree. According to the Illinois Comptroller's Office database, Acosta's salary in 2019 was $95,900. Paulovin's was $189,000. Each man was charged with two felony counts of endangering the life of a child and one felony count of reckless conduct. They both bonded out almost immediately, and their cases are currently pending. Finally, during a negotiated plea hearing on the afternoon of Friday, September 18, 2020, Drew Frund accepted a plea agreement in which the majority of his criminal charges were dropped in exchange for his guilty plea to three charges: aggravated battery of a child, involuntary manslaughter, and concealment of a homicidal death. As a result of the agreement between the prosecution and the defense, Judge Robert Wilbrandt sentenced Drew on the spot. For count one, aggravated battery of a child, a Class X felony, Drew was sentenced to 11 years in the Illinois Department of Corrections, with 3 years of mandatory supervised release to follow. He will serve a minimum of 85% of that sentence. For count two, involuntary manslaughter, a Class 2 felony, Drew was sentenced to 14 years in prison with 2 years of mandatory supervised release. He will serve a minimum of 50% of that sentence. For count three, concealment of a homicidal death, a Class 3 felony, Drew received 5 years in prison with 1 year of mandatory supervised release. The three prison terms are to be served consecutively for the protection of the public. Since he was given credit for his time served since his arrest, which totaled almost 17 months, that means Drew could be walking the streets as early as February of 2038. According to the Illinois DOC website, Drew's projected parole eligibility date is January 23, 2043, and his projected discharge date is January 24, 2046. When Drew is released from prison, he must register as a violent offender against youth. He must also cooperate in the ongoing DCFS investigation into AJ's death, including giving truthful interviews. Finally, he must participate in a series of interviews with the FBI's National Center for Analysis of Violent Crime, Behavioral Analysis Unit 3, for research purposes, which will take place over a period of several days. I hope to God they publish those interviews, or at least the transcripts. I don't believe Drew was physically responsible for AJ's death, but he certainly had every opportunity to intervene. He knew what Joanne was doing to that little boy, and he allowed it. I'm very interested in the psychology behind that mindset. Drew's DOC profile currently shows his offender status as reception, and he's located at the Northern Reception Center of the Statesville Correctional Center. He will remain in reception status until he's transferred to a permanent institution. The processing time varies for each inmate at the reception center, where privileges and movement are limited. In his prison photo, he looks a bit like if the Unabomber and Santa Claus had a baby who was born elderly and homeless. I can't deny I shed a few bitter tears after Drew's sentencing hearing ended. AJ stole my heart from the moment I first saw his photo. He was the first child I covered on both the blog and the podcast, and after combing through his story over and over again, I can't help thinking he deserved better, both in life and in death. I'm sure we can all agree that his murderers, particularly his mother, for actively committing the ultimate betrayal against her son, deserve more time in prison than they received, but I can't fault Prosecutor Patrick Keneally for negotiating plea bargains with both Joanne and Drew. Prosecutors often do so for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is to save the state's taxpayers millions of dollars for a costly trial. On top of that, there's no guarantee that taking a defendant to trial will result in justice either. If we learned anything from the 2011 trial of Casey Anthony for the murder of her 2-year-old daughter Kaylee in 2008, it's that even the most obviously guilty defendants can be acquitted if the jury is stupid or gullible enough, or if the prosecution's case fails to live up to the CSI standard. This is what will have to serve as justice for AJ, at least as far as his parents are concerned. No matter what, though, I know I'll never forget AJ, or allow his memory to fade, or his face to be forgotten. Episode 2 featured the story of Ohio baby Dylan Groves, who was born on January 10, 2019, and whose broken body was found at the bottom of a well 153 days later, just 2 miles from his family's home in Otway. By the time the episode was released, Dylan's worthless, drug-addled parents, Daniel and Jessica Groves, had both been convicted and sentenced. I was glued to every minute of their trial, which took place in January of this year, and was live-streamed by the Law and Crime Trial Network. Daniel was sentenced to 47 years to life in prison and will be eligible for parole when he is 89 years old. The only updates to this case are the inmates' locations. 43-year-old Daniel is currently incarcerated in the Toledo Correctional Institution. His first parole hearing won't take place until April of 2066. Jessica was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Now aged 41, she's calling the Dayton Correctional Institution home these days. Other than that, there's really not much else to update in Dylan's case. He would have turned 2 next month, and like I do for all of these kids, I'll light a candle in Dylan's memory on his special day. The next story I covered was that of 6-year-old Zamir Perkins, the subject of Episode 3. Zamir died on September 26, 2016, after months of chronic abuse by his mother, Geraldine Perkins, and her boyfriend, Raishim Smith. While squatting in a Harlem apartment without electricity, Raishim savagely beat Zamir with a broken broom handle and a shower curtain rod, hung him from a hook on the bathroom door, and finally threw him into a bedroom to die between the wall and the bed. Geraldine cleaned the apartment, read her Bible, and put on some makeup and a wig before carrying Zamir, already dead, to the emergency room hours later. Zamir suffered from malnutrition as well as multiple acute injuries, including at least 30 healed rib fractures, various lacerations, scrapes and bruises, and a contusion on his head. His injuries were compared to those of someone who had been hit by a car. Geraldine accepted a plea deal, pleading guilty to manslaughter and agreeing to testify against Raishim in exchange for a paltry sentence of 2 to 6 years. Raishim was convicted on January 20, 2020 of second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, second-degree manslaughter, and 2 counts of endangering the welfare of a child. His sentencing has been scheduled and rescheduled multiple times since then, delayed further by the pandemic. He was most recently scheduled to be sentenced on December 3rd, but once again, the hearing was continued. He is currently being held at the Vernon C. Bain Center Jail Facility in the Bronx and is scheduled to receive his sentence on April 1st, 2021. As for Geraldine, I was unpleasantly surprised a few months ago when I learned she was released on parole in September of this year. 30-year-old Geraldine Perkins walked free from the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women on September 17th. This is yet another case in which a plea agreement allowed a terrible person to receive a sorely inadequate sentence. But again, plea agreements are a little like deals with the devil. In this case, to ensure Raishim Smith's conviction, prosecutors likely felt they had no choice but to offer Geraldine a deal. If they hadn't, she and Raishim almost definitely would have pointed the finger at each other, and that could have led to both of them walking free or being convicted on much lesser charges. At the very least, with Raishim convicted, there is some measure of justice for the 6-year-old boy whose loving family called him Zai Zai. In Episode 4, I told you the story of a sweet, kind 8-year-old West Virginia girl named Raylee Jolynn Browning, whose father, Marty Browning, shot her mother, Janice Riston, out of their daughter's life after moving his girlfriend, Julie Tichenelle, her three children, and her sister, Sherry Tichenelle, into the house with them. When suspicion arose that Rayleigh was being abused, the three adults pulled Rayleigh out of public school under the guise of homeschooling, which only accelerated the abuse and neglect. At the time of her death, Rayleigh was prescribed 7 different psychiatric medications, which has since raised the question of possible medical abuse. Rayleigh's father and the Tichenelle sisters withheld food, water, education, and medical care from little Rayleigh as well. At one point, another child in the home told investigators that Rayleigh became so thirsty that she was forced to drink from the toilet. Rayleigh died on December 26, 2018, from severe septic infection
due to necrotizing bronchopneumonia with diffuse alveolar damage of uncertain etiology.
Her autopsy also revealed her little body was covered with bruises, lacerations, and burns, and her rectum was torn at the time of her death. Marty and Julie Browning, who married shortly after Rayleigh's death, and Sherry Tichenelle were arrested on December 19, 2019, almost a full year after Rayleigh died. Each was charged with both death of a child by a parent, guardian, or custodian, and child neglect resulting in death. And finally, on June 18, 2020, all three were indicted on their charges. West Virginia is very stingy when it comes to making details known about ongoing criminal court cases, and on top of that, a gag order has been issued in Rayleigh's case, so it's next to impossible to get any information. The indictment is the most recent update I have, but at least we know these three pathetic excuses for human beings will at some point be tried for what they did to Rayleigh. Both Janice, Rayleigh's mom, and Rayleigh's stepdad, Jeremy, reached out to me in June to let me know that they enjoyed my episode about Rayleigh. Jeremy told me,
"You are the voice for Rayleigh Jolynn. We are very pleased with your podcast and urge you to keep talking about Rayleigh. She was a beautiful little girl with a heart so full of love."
Janice, who shared several beautiful and heartbreaking photos of her little girl, said,
"Rayleigh was my heart, and now and forever it will always be broken. She was the most adorable, sweet, smart, innocent, loving, happy, healthy, snuggly baby girl with a heart full of love."
Since Rayleigh gained her wings the day after Christmas 2 years ago, this time of year has to be difficult for Janice, Jeremy, and Rayleigh's siblings, and my heart goes out to them. They will absolutely be in my thoughts during the holiday season. Next is the story of Thomas Valva, who was the subject of episodes 5 and 6. Thomas was 8 years old when he died on January 17, 2020, after his father, Michael Valva, a New York City police officer, and his fiancée, Angela Polina, allegedly forced Thomas and his 10-year-old brother, Anthony, both of whom have autism, to spend the night in the unheated garage of the family's Long Island home. Anthony survived. Thomas, unfortunately, succumbed to hypothermia, and he also had injuries to his head, face, knees, elbows, and right flank that did not match Michael's account of Thomas falling down in the driveway that morning. Both Michael Valva and Angela Polina were arrested and charged with second-degree murder and child endangerment. They have been in custody since their arrests in January, at which time Michael, a 15-year veteran of the NYPD who had, most recently, been assigned to the department's traffic bureau, was suspended without pay pending the outcome of the criminal case. The two have had multiple court hearings throughout the year, although not much of substance has taken place in the case. The most interesting development so far was that in November, Michael voluntarily resigned from the NYPD. According to Michael's attorney, John Loturco,
"He executed paperwork in that regard, which protects his benefits and his pension. There's no admission of wrongdoing. It allows him to forego the disciplinary hearing, and in exchange, he will no longer receive any salary or any future benefits."
Well, so much for protecting his pension, because according to NYPD spokesman Sergeant Jessica McRory, Michael Valva resigned without permission from the police commissioner.
"He will not be receiving a pension. However, he will receive any money he contributed to the pension system back."
Both Michael and Angela have pleaded not guilty to the charges against them and face 25 years to life if convicted. Loturco also told reporters he planned to file a motion for severance of Michael and Angela's cases, saying their defenses are antagonistic. As far as I can tell, that means they're planning to blame each other for Thomas's death. The boy's mother, Justina Zubko Valva, spent years documenting the abuse Michael doled out on their three boys, especially Anthony and Thomas, both of whom had special needs. Thomas and Anthony were often sent to school with inadequate food, wearing filthy, sometimes urine-stained clothing, or even diapers despite their advanced ages. School officials made reports to CPS about this, as well as seeing the boys eat scraps out of garbage cans. Justina repeatedly reported the boys' severe abuse to Child Protective Services, the police, family court, and anyone else who would listen, but her pleas fell on deaf ears. Her story is one of the most egregious examples I've ever seen of the failure of CPS and the family court system to protect children who clearly needed it. I've seen it time and time again. The family court system, unfortunately, tends to favor men, especially those with wealth and connections. In June, Justina filed a $200 million wrongful death lawsuit against multiple parties, including several CPS caseworkers, investigators, and supervisors, the East Moriches Union Free School District, the principal and superintendent of Thomas's school, Nassau County Supreme Court Justice Hope Schwartz Zimmerman, Donna McCabe and Ethan Halpern, both attorneys assigned to represent the Valva boys, Suffolk County Department of Social Services County Attorney Randall Ratchey, and Michael Valva and Angela Polina. In Justina's filing, her attorney, John Norensberg of Manhattan, stated that
the tragedy started on September 6, 2017, when Nassau County Supreme Court Justice Hope Schwartz Zimmerman unlawfully and without due process, a hearing or supporting evidence against Ms. Zubko Valva, gave custody of her three children, including Tommy, to Michael Valva, even though a prior judge in the case had barred Valva from overnight visits. Tommy's death was not only foreseeable, but completely preventable.
Now get this. Michael's criminal attorney, Luterco, doesn't represent him in the civil lawsuit, but he did have something to say about it.
We do concur with his estranged wife that while there was systemic failure by CPS in the lack of their ability to remove the children in a timely manner, after we've reviewed the evidence, we have come to the conclusion that the children should have been managed more properly by CPS as well as the school system. But that has no impact on our defense in the criminal matter, and we continue to zealously and aggressively assert his innocence as it pertains to the criminal indictment and the top charge of murder in the second degree.
Whoops, time for one of my favorite sound bites.
First of all, a fucking pardon?
The fact that Luterco is speaking out of both sides of his mouth by blaming CPS and the school, while also absolving Michael of any blame in Thomas's abuse and death, exemplifies why many people consider attorneys to be soulless and unscrupulous. One final update on Thomas's case before I move on to the next. Justina has also alleged sexual abuse of the boys by Michael and Angela, even mentioning possible child trafficking. It will be interesting to see if those allegations are addressed with criminal charges, or at all for that matter. Justina, a Polish immigrant, recently tweeted,
Tommy recently appeared in one of his brother's dream, being thankful for the Gregorian masses that we had ordered in his intention, and stating that they also helped many other souls to receive a gift of heaven. I strongly believe Tommy is in heaven and helps us in this difficult journey, fighting for justice, not only for Tommy and his brothers, but also for all other abused children who cannot defend themselves.
The next case with updates is that of 12-year-old Alex Hurley, whose story I told in Episode 7. Alex died in February at the West Yellowstone, Montana home of his paternal grandmother and her husband. Alex was living with his dad, Tommy Tate, when Tommy died in 2018 of complications from surgery to treat his paralysis from an earlier ATV accident. Instead of sending Alex back to live with his mother, Alicia Davis, in Texas, Tommy's mother, Patricia Batts, swooped in and took her grandson into her home, but not out of the goodness of her heart. Although she has not yet been convicted of anything, it's suspected that Patricia took Alex in so she would receive Tommy's death benefits. While Alicia reportedly tried multiple times to contact Alex, Patricia stonewalled any kind of communication. In Patricia's home also lived her husband, James Sasser Jr., and the couple's three children, 18-year-old Madison, 14-year-old James III, and a 6-year-old boy. When Alex was found dead on the living room floor on February 3rd of this year, Patricia told investigators that the 12-year-old had behavioral issues, including harming himself by running headfirst into walls and doors, hearing voices urging him to commit violent acts against the family, and scratching himself till he bled. Just like in Ray Lee's case, Alex was ultimately pulled from school as a result of these behavioral issues, which neither staff at his school nor his mother, with whom he lived for the majority of his life, had ever witnessed. Alex's body was covered in various wounds and contusions, including severe bruises on his buttocks that were likely caused by a paddle, other posterior contusions, and a large gash on the back of his head. It eventually came out that Alex's 14-year-old uncle, James, often engaged in physical altercations with the younger boy, and that James had kicked Alex in the head. Alex's death was ruled a homicide caused by blunt force trauma to the back of his head. The family's involvement in Alex's death really came to light when investigators found multiple video recordings on their various phones depicting unfathomable abuse, even torture, against Alex. Patricia, in particular, forced him to perform physical exercise as punishment, beat him, forced him to stand, wet and barely clothed, in front of a fan, deprived him of food and sleep, and even had her 6-year-old son spray him in the face with rubbing alcohol. In one video, a family friend even got involved, beating Alex with a piece of wood. Ultimately, 5 people were arrested in connection with Alex's death: 48-year-old Patricia Batts, 47-year-old James Sasser Jr., 18-year-old Madison Sasser, 14-year-old James Sasser III, and 18-year-old Gage Rausch. Since I released episode 7, there have been a few updates in Alex's case. Gage, the family friend, requested his bail of $50,000 be lowered so he could get a job and live with his grandmother. But Gallatin County District Judge Holly Brown denied the bond reduction, citing threats made against Gage by people both out of state and in West Yellowstone. She said,
"The community of West Yellowstone is notably small, and people are very aware of who is there and where they are and what they're doing. There are concerns related to our community reaction that could put Mr. Rausch at risk, and it certainly could put other community members at risk."
She also cited the severity of Gage's charge as another reason for her decision. Gage, who has no criminal history or record of violence, is charged with felony assault on a minor. On May 8th, Madison Sasser appeared before Judge Holly Brown, alongside her attorney, Elizabeth Montoya, where she entered not guilty pleas to both of her charges, aggravated kidnapping and negligent homicide. Prosecutors allege Madison was well aware of the way her brother and her mother physically abused her nephew, and even witnessed James III smashing Alex's head into a wall so hard it left a dent in the plaster just 2 days before Alex died. Text messages Madison sent her boyfriend also indicate she was involved in the abuse to a degree. In one message, she texted,
"I'm so heartless to him, dude, honestly. I beat the shit out of him just now."
Later, she added that she
beat the shit out of him, my fucking hands hurt.
Also in May, Gallatin County Prosecutor Bjorn Boyer filed a notice with the court stating his intention to seek the death penalty against Patricia Batts, who has been charged with 4 felonies: deliberate homicide, aggravated kidnapping, criminal child endangerment, and strangulation of a partner or family member. Patricia is accused of being the ringleader of this fucked up family circus, initiating the culture of abuse in the home against her own dead son's little boy by beating and torturing Alex and guiding her monstrous teenagers to do the same. Even if Patricia is convicted and sentenced to death, whether or not the death penalty would ever be carried out is up in the air. The last time an inmate in Montana was executed was in 2006. There are currently 2 people on Montana's death row in the maximum security unit at Montana State Prison. William J. Gollahan, who was convicted in 1992 of deliberate homicide after murdering 5 other inmates during a prison riot in 1991, and Ronald Allen Smith, who was convicted in 1983 of 2 counts each of deliberate homicide and aggravated kidnapping. Smith was sentenced to die 37 years ago, and he's still on death row. It says a lot about Alex's case that prosecutors are even bothering to seek the death penalty. It may be more of a symbolic gesture than anything, and I'm staunchly against capital punishment for a variety of reasons, but if the allegations against Patricia Batts are true, there is no one more deserving of the ultimate punishment. Most recently, on Thursday, October 29th, James Sasser III, who is now 15 years old, accepted a plea deal in Gallatin County Court. As part of the agreement, Judge John Brown declared he wouldn't charge James as an adult. Prosecutor Boyer agreed with his decision. By accepting the plea agreement, James pleaded guilty to felony deliberate homicide by accountability and immediately received his sentence. He was ordered to be imprisoned at a juvenile detention facility until he turns 18. Once he's released, he will remain on probation until he is 25. He has been ordered to remain in mental health counseling during the entirety of his detention and probation. He will not be required to register as a violent offender, and he cannot have unsupervised contact with anyone under the age of 18, with the exception of fellow detainees. He was also ordered to pay $500 in restitution to the Crime Victims Compensation Fund. In a written statement detailing the crime, James said he had been duct-taped to Alex the night before his nephew's death, which was a common tactic employed by the family, supposedly to prevent Alex from running away. James wrote,
"I woke up and the duct tape was almost off. I re-taped it with one little line of tape. After that, Alex moved and my arm touched the heater. I got up and started punching him. I pushed him and he fell into the wall. His head crashed into the wall and I punched him and pushed him over. I caused him serious bodily injury, and I believe that led to Alex's death. Alex died sometime that next night.
Patricia Batts and James Sasser Jr. are still being held in the Gallatin County Jail. I was unable to find the status of either Madison Sasser or Gage Rausch. As for the plea agreement and sentence James Sasser III received, my feelings are mixed. I was very strongly against him being tried as an adult, because at the age of 14, his brain wasn't even halfway to being fully developed, which doesn't happen until between age 25 and 27. Hard prison time wouldn't benefit him nor anyone he encountered once he was released. In fact, it can be exceptionally damaging to adolescents. I believe he will need intensive mental health treatment to overcome the brainwashing heaped upon him by his narcissistic mother. We can only hope the therapy he's ordered to continue until he reaches the age of 25 will be able to accomplish that. No matter how you slice it, this story embodies tragedy from all angles. Alex Hurley spent the last several months of his life in terror and agony at the hands of his late father's family. We can only hold out hope that the justice he deserves will be served. Episode 8 concerned a case I've been particularly interested in for many years, a case that was among the few I consider the impetus for creating my blog in the first place. Alyssa Guernsey was 16 months old when she died on March 28, 2009, in Topeka, Indiana. An autopsy revealed unthinkable injuries to Alyssa's little body, including bruises on the top of her head, both on the scalp and in the tissue between the scalp and the skull. There were multiple bruises on the baby's face and a fresh contusion on her left thigh. She was missing patches of hair, which was determined to have been torn out rather than falling out on its own. She had suffered bilateral subdural hematoma, which means blood had collected between her brain and her skull on both sides of her head. Alyssa had two horrific lacerations inside her mouth where her gums met her lips on both the top and the bottom, and she also had a broken left elbow and a growth plate displacement, as well as internal injuries. Alyssa's death was ruled a homicide caused by blunt force injury to the head. For a few months prior to her death, Alyssa was in the care of her mother's cousin, Christy Schaefer, and her husband, Matt. Alyssa's daddy had recently died in a car accident, and her mom, Kelly Sprunger, had asked her cousin, Christy, to care for her three children while she worked through her worsening depression, which had, unfortunately, spiraled into drug use. Despite a great deal of evidence against Christy, LaGrange County Prosecutor Jeffrey Weibel chose to convene a grand jury for the first time in his lengthy career, rather than decide himself what charges should be filed. The grand jury indicted Christy on a Class B felony charge of neglect of a dependent, resulting in serious injury. Not murder, not manslaughter, not even a Class A felony charge of neglect resulting in death, even though Alyssa was very much dead and her death ruled a homicide. Christy ended up pleading guilty and throwing herself on the mercy of the court, and it turned out that LaGrange County Circuit Court Judge J. Scott Vanderbeck had a hell of a lot of mercy for Christy, who happened to be the daughter of a prominent banker in town with whom the judge had a friendly relationship. The judge, even taking the time to blame Kelly for her own daughter's death, sentenced Christy to 10 years, with 6 of those years suspended. He also told her attorney to come back after Christy underwent testing at the Department of Correction Diagnostic Center, at which time he would
entertain a motion for her early release.
Worse yet, when Christy and her attorney returned to court on August 11, 2011, Judge Vanderbeck literally freed her on the spot, ordering her to serve 6 months of home detention and 3 years of probation. So how much time in total did Christy spend behind bars for Alyssa's death? 77 days. No amount of public outcry and no number of protests could change a damn thing about it either. Besides Christy spending more time in prison for later allowing a meth lab to operate out of her home, she's gone all but unpunished for beating her cousin's toddler to death. Needless to say, much of the public's anger has been pointed in the direction of Judge Vanderbeck and Prosecutor Weibel, neither of whom had ever granted an official interview after the conclusion of the case. Judge Vanderbeck remains silent on the matter, but Jeff Weibel, who recently lost the race for an Indiana State Senate seat, agreed to an interview on my podcast, which you can hear in episode 25, Alyssa Guernsey Revisited. I asked Mr. Weibel every question I could think of in regard to Alyssa's case, and he was generally quick to answer. However, most longtime followers of Alyssa's case were of the opinion that Mr. Weibel's answers, to put it diplomatically, might be better put to use as fertilizer. I'll let you decide. Most importantly, though, the conversation about Alyssa Beth Guernsey is not over, and her memory will forever be kept alive by those of us whose hearts overflow with love for the little girl widely known as Baby Dragonfly. In fact, friend of the blog Marshall Talbert and a few of his friends recently drove from Indiana to the cemetery in Bronson, Michigan, where Alyssa's ashes are buried in her daddy's grave. A few years ago, members of an online group called Alyssa's Army, led by human superhero Bernadette Bucafori, designed and paid for a beautiful memorial bench, which was placed in Alyssa's honor in another part of the cemetery. I've had the opportunity since my first episode about Alyssa was released to visit the cemetery myself and pay my respects to Baby Dragonfly in person, which meant more to me than I can express. Well, as I mentioned, Marty Talbert and his friends visited Alyssa's bench recently and spent some time scrubbing it down, leaving it sparkling clean before decorating it for the holidays. I'll include some photos from Marty in the Facebook album for this episode. It's just heartwarming that there are still so many people who keep Alyssa's precious little face in their hearts. She might never get true justice, but she'll certainly never be forgotten. The case I covered in Episode 9, that of Amy Lynn Deal, unfortunately has no update at this time. Four of the five members of Amy's family who were convicted in her death remain in prison, although her grandmother, Judith Deal, was released earlier this year, as I mentioned in the episode. Amy's cousin, Samantha Allen, and her husband, John, are the first Arizona couple ever sentenced to death. If any update comes along for Amy's story, I'll be sure to cover it on the blog and mention it in a future update episode. Episode 10 concerned the story of 2-year-old Noah Tomlin, who was reported missing by his mother, Julia, from the family's mobile home in Hampton, Virginia, on June 24, 2019. 4 days later, amid a massive multi-day search, Hampton police arrested Julia and charged her in Noah's disappearance, announcing that they believed Noah to be dead. Noah's partial remains were found on July 1, 2019, at the city landfill and steam plant, and an autopsy later revealed that Noah's death was caused by 2 skull fractures, which were described to be as severe as those incurred by a child falling from a multiple-story building, and his remains showed signs of multiple older injuries, invoking the possible diagnosis of battered child syndrome. In January, Julia's trial was scheduled to take place in March of 2020, but through her attorney, Julia requested a competency evaluation. Julia had previously been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, attention deficit disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. On July 8th, she was found competent to stand trial, and her jury trial was scheduled to take place from April 16th through 21st, 2021. At a bond review hearing on July 21st, Julia's request to reduce her bond was denied. She has been held at the Hampton Roads Regional Jail since her arrest. I'm really hoping her trial doesn't get pushed back any further, so I'll be crossing my fingers for April 16th. In episode 11, I told you the story of Logan Klein, an 11-year-old boy whose remains were discovered in the trunk of an abandoned car in Wichita Falls, Texas, on February 26th of this year. This discovery came about as the result of a domestic violence report made in Las Vegas, Nevada, by Logan's mother, 37-year-old Stormy Johnson, who told police that her 31-year-old boyfriend, Corey Trumbull, beat the living shit out of her with a pipe and choked her with a dog chain. Stormy suffered multiple broken bones, bruises, swelling, and lacerations, and required orthopedic surgery to repair the damage this Neanderthal caused. For the abuse allegations, Corey was arrested in Las Vegas and charged with misdemeanor domestic battery, as well as 4 felony charges, first-degree kidnapping, domestic battery with a deadly weapon resulting in significant bodily harm, domestic battery by strangulation, and coercion constituting domestic violence using threat or physical force. Stormy also told police where they would find her son's body, claiming that Corey was responsible for that too. Official autopsy results have not been released, but a friend of the family received a message from Logan's father, U.S. Military First Sergeant Nicholas Klein, stating that Logan's cause of death was blunt force trauma. Stormy was arrested in Las Vegas on February 29th on a Texas fugitive warrant for tampering with evidence in connection with Logan's death. Corey, who was still in custody in Nevada, received 2 charges from Texas as well, tampering with evidence and capital murder. He was indicted on those charges in April. To make an already terrible story much worse, in March, both Corey and Stormy were charged in Nevada with a host of sex crimes, including possession of visual pornography of a person under 16, 3 counts of sexual assault against a child under 16, 2 counts of lewd acts committed by a person over 18 with a child of 14 or 15, and child abuse or neglect. The details investigators released about these crimes were incredibly disturbing. At the time these acts were allegedly committed, the couple was living in their pickup truck with Stormy's 15-year-old daughter and three dogs. Allegedly, Stormy spent much of that time period getting herself as fucked up on meth as possible to remove herself from reality. Well, in August, I spent several days looking into every case I had covered up to that point on both the blog and the podcast to find out the status of the various court cases. And while digging into Logan's case, I was surprised to find that the Nevada charges for both his drug-addled mother and her demonic boyfriend had been adjudicated, but it was never covered by a single news outlet. In the State of Nevada versus Stormy Johnson, a guilty plea agreement was accepted on May 1, 2020. It appears this agreement allowed Stormy to plead guilty to a single felony charge of child abuse. The rest of her Nevada charges appear to have been dismissed. The court heard victim impact statements on June 12th, and on June 23rd, Stormy was sentenced to 12 to 30 months in the Nevada Department of Corrections, with 98 days credit for time served. She was remanded to the Florence McClure Women's Correctional Center in Las Vegas to serve her sentence. She is eligible for parole starting on March 16, 2021, and is scheduled for a parole hearing on December 30th of this year. Her sentence's projected expiration date is listed on the Nevada DOC website as July 31, 2021. As for Stormy's evidence tampering charge in Texas related to Logan's death, there are currently no court hearings scheduled, and it's entirely possible that there won't be one until after she finishes her sentence in Nevada. There are also no hearings scheduled on Corey Trumbull's evidence tampering and capital murder charges in Texas. In Nevada, Corey entered a plea agreement on May 19th, pleading guilty to two felony charges, lewd acts committed by a person over 18 with a child of 14 or 15, and child abuse. In turn, it appears the rest of the charges were dropped, and he was sentenced on August 4th. For count one, lewdness with a child, Corey received a sentence of 2 to 10 years to run concurrently with his sentence on count two, which was 2 to 5 years. He received a credit of 149 days time served. Corey must also register as a sex offender with lifetime supervision, and he was ordered to pay the victim $1,293.80 in restitution. On his felony charges in relation to beating Stormy to a pulp, Corey pleaded guilty on June 24th to a felony charge of battery with a deadly weapon. Victim impact statements were entered on July 1st, and on August 5th, Corey was sentenced to 2 to 10 years to be served again concurrently with his other sentence. Credit for time served on that charge was 161 days. Corey was remanded on August 25th to High Desert State Prison in Indiana Springs, Nevada, to serve his sentence. His scheduled release date is listed as May 11, 2025, after which I hope he'll be handed over to the Texas legal system so he can stare down the barrel of his capital murder charge. I'll check in the new year for any update after Stormy's parole hearing, so keep an eye on the blog for updates. The last case I'll address in today's episode is the one I covered in episode 12, Amari Boone. Amari was 3 years old when he was fatally injured while in the care of his foster fathers in Fort Worth, Texas, on April 10th of this year. Amari and his 19-month-old brother were in foster care, to make a long story short, because his mother and father had lost their home and their transportation. After being shuffled from caregiver to caregiver, the boys were placed into the home of family friend Deondrick Foley and his partner Joseph M. Delancey II. Amari's parents, Ariana George and Rodney Boone, were comfortable with the arrangement at first because they were both good friends with Dion. After the coronavirus quarantine began, Amari began suffering injuries, including a sprained ankle he supposedly suffered from falling down the stairs, as well as bruises, swollen eyes, and a swollen lip, which Ariana photographed and sent to her CPS caseworker, the caseworker's supervisor, and her children's attorney. Despite these injuries, Amari's parents were forced to take the boys back to their foster home, although they requested the injuries be investigated. Amari was evaluated at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth, and although a report noted that the bruises were concerning, a removal order was not issued. Amari suffered more injuries, including a split lip, which his foster parents explained away by saying his baby brother hit him in the face with a TV remote, and a black eye, which they said was caused when he ran face first into a fence. Then, on Good Friday, Amari was admitted to the hospital with extensive injuries. After 2 days in a coma, Amari was declared brain dead and removed from life support, and he slipped away at 1:19 a.m. on Easter Sunday, just 2 months away from his 4th birthday. Deondrick Foley and Joseph Delancey have not been named as official suspects by the Fort Worth Police Department, and to date, no arrests have been made in Amari's death, despite the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office determining Amari's death was caused by blunt force trauma to the head and ruling the little boy's death a homicide. Amari's 19-month-old brother was fortunately removed from his foster parents' home the same evening Amari was fatally injured. The Fort Worth Police Department has evidently written up an affidavit for at least one arrest, although the details of the affidavit are currently unknown. They submitted this to the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office in October and even told Amari's family that justice was coming for their precious boy. However, the District Attorney's Office has thus far refused to act on the affidavit for over 2 months now, stubbornly refusing to issue a warrant based on the Fort Worth PD's investigation. Many of us believe the DA's office is trying to cover its own ass, as well as the collective asses of CPS, Tarrant County, and the state of Texas. CPS bears a great deal of responsibility for Amari's death after failing to act on his parents' concerns, including photographic evidence, flimsy stories from his foster fathers, and a mounting number of injuries. Light for the Missing, a volunteer organization, maintains a Facebook group called Justice for Amari Boone, and on a Change.org petition demanding justice for Amari, they've collected almost 329,000 signatures. Amari was one of 9 children, ages 4 or younger, who were admitted to Cook Children's Hospital between March 17th and April 23rd of this year for injuries from child abuse. He was one of 3 children who died from their injuries. All 3 deaths were ruled homicides due to blunt force trauma. Cook Children's typically sees an average of 6 child abuse deaths in an entire year. The other 2 children, 4-year-old Stetson Blackburn and 3-year-old Arika Taylor, both died on March 21st. 2 arrests were made in Stetson's case on July 31st when his mother, Shannon Gray, and her girlfriend, Reyna Sanchez, were charged with capital murder of a person under 10 in Stetson's death. Arika's accused murderer, her mother's boyfriend, Tony Manns, was arrested by the Fort Worth Police Department's Fugitive Unit on October 14th and also charged with capital murder of a person under 10. I hope to do another episode on Amari's case in the near future. It's his turn for justice, and his family and supporters will not rest until he gets it. I hope you guys have enjoyed this update episode. If you did, let me know, and I'll definitely release another one in the future so I can update you on several more cases. For now, I wish you and your loved ones a happy, healthy holiday season, no matter what that looks like during this pandemic. Here's to a fantastic new year, and here's hoping we can all enter 2021 with hope for the future. Thank you all so much for listening and reading, for rating and reviewing the podcast, and thank you for your pledges, your likes and comments and interaction on my social media posts, your emails, your case suggestions, your constructive feedback, and your all-around support. Most of all, thank you for caring about these children as much as I do. That's it for this week, guys. Join me in 2 weeks for another episode. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.